Okay. Hi, everyone. I'm just going to plug in. It should just be a few seconds. And my slides are a little bit last minute because I ended up having to deal with this stupid Skype thing, so my apologies for that. Okay. Sorry? I will a bit later, but okay. I'm just going to try and get it on both so I can actually follow what I'm supposed to be saying. Oh, and it's gone off the side. Oh, you'll get the general point, I think. Oh, maybe I just put it straight up. A few things are going to run off the side, so my apologies for that. Some of you know me, some of you don't. My name's Pia War. I've been a geek for my entire life. I'm very happy with that. My background is basically almost 10 years in the industry, and then last April I got plucked from my little two-person business to work as a policy advisor for a politician in Australia, but don't hold that against me. So, what I'm going to do today is talk about basically this idea of establishing core principles and practice for this idea of open government. So, first of all, what happens, I think I'm going to, oh no, it's probably going to work. What happens when you basically take a politician and a geek, I believe, is world domination. I think that it's been quite fascinating because a lot of the stuff we've been doing, so I better actually start from the beginning. I've known Senator Kate Lundy for about 5 years. The way I came across her was I was one of the advocates against the DMCA like chapter in the Australia-US Free Trade Agreement, and I was trying to do a lot of, you know, raising awareness about that. And then I saw that the Shadow Minister of ICT at the time, which was Kate, was going to be giving a speech in my local town, which was Sydney. So I went along and listened to it. It was extremely informed. It was against the IP chapter. It understood the issues in terms of the speech, and very shortly thereafter, she lost being the Shadow Minister of ICT, which was rather unfortunate. But it was great to see someone who actually got it. So I've kept in touch over the years, and it's been wonderful to have her participate in things like Software Freedom Day and various other sort of events around openness and freedom. So. She hired me specifically because she wanted to get back into focusing on ICT, and she wanted very much to focus on open government. What can we do to make government in Australia more open, more accessible, more transparent, to make it work better given the fact that the world is different now, technology has brought people close together, and we have the ability to tap into the general community in a way that we've just never been able to do before, and a way for them to participate in the process of government in a way that we've never had before. So she, when I first came on board, we sat down and we started thinking about what we can do to try and improve our bit. So we wanted to sort of have a think about, at the time, this whole Gov2O term was starting to be bandied about, and it's the most stupid term, and I am not take no responsibility for using the term Government 2.0, but it has created a bit of a revolution, because suddenly people in governments all around the world are thinking about openness, are thinking about data, are thinking, you know, are using terms like metadata that they've never heard of before, are considering the you know, actually crowdsourcing, actually doing a collaborative design of a policy with the general public, which is a really exciting thing. But we've sort of defined, I guess, three core elements of Government 2.0, which isn't exactly the same, I don't think, as open government, but is close. And the three core overlying principles that we've sort of come up with and that we've been looking at are open and transparent government. So that's about how government works. What are the processes of government? How can you open them up? How can you make the decision-making more transparent, more participatory, more inclusive? How can you make government more, the process of government more accountable? This is obviously a very, very big topic and something that we're trying to work on a lot at the moment. The second one is around citizen-centric services, which primarily is actually about the public sector. How many people here work in the public sector? Okay, about a third of you, quarter of you. How many people work in some sort of political office? that one probably, yeah, one. the difference therein is actually quite significant, and I'll actually come to that in a second. But looking at how the public sector can actually deliver its services in a more in a way which is focused on individuals. An individual should be able to find information that is relevant to them there and there, and unique to their particular needs, without having to wade through thousands of different pages and be diverted to four different departments or agencies. And this is a whole different way of looking at delivering government services, but it's something that there's a lot of work happening around the world, and I'm very proud to say there's some great stuff happening in Australia. And the third one, it's a kind of wanky title, and my apologies, and anyone here that has been involved in Linux Australia at any point in time will find it kind of funny that I'm using this term, but facilitating innovation. The idea is open data is important. Open data is only a part of the pie. We need to look at what are all the kinds of things the government can do to actually create the opportunity for business, for the general public, for NGOs to innovate on what government does. So open data, opening the APIs of government services and solutions and websites, making sure that open standards are being used, you know, what are all the different sort of things? Today, open data is obviously one of the biggest priorities, but what's going to be a priority tomorrow, we don't know. So a bigger core principle of facilitating innovation we thought was kind of an important one. The Obama principle. Now, I love how you've got all of these new fancy social media consultants out there, 80% of whom have no idea what they're talking about. And the first thing they usually say, so here's what Obama did. And the Obama principle usually, certainly in Australian government anyway, is sort of like, well, if it worked for Obama, it'll work for us. And I sort of hold that that's not true. There's a huge difference between the public sector and between political use of social media and government 2.0, if you like. And I think it's really important that we differentiate and establish that, first of all, there's that difference. But the other thing is that while there has been some amazing stuff, and what Obama has managed to achieve is fantastic in many, many ways, particularly, I believe, in the empowering of citizens to actually get involved. But, you know, in terms of Australia, and again, it's going to be different in New Zealand, but I can only reflect on what we're doing in Australia. In Australia, we have mandatory voting. So trying to encourage people to vote isn't, you know, a priority. People are going to vote anyway. We have a different sort of government. We have a different sort of culture. So being able to learn from what we can learn is great, but applying it verbatim is not the way to go. So it's been an important distinction for us. So in terms of politics versus the public sector, there's different needs and priorities between those two. There's a different relationship that the two have to citizens. And although, of course, a department or agency generally is going to have to be aligned with what its ministerial office is saying and doing, there are going to be slightly different goals, of course. And so you need to take those into account when looking at how these principles apply in the different ways. So I wanted to briefly go through what's happening in Australia. You've obviously heard from the task force today, and you've heard from, you're hearing from a few different people, but just to give you a brief overview, because we're at a really exciting time in Australia, and I think with the change that we're seeing just even in the last 12 months, this next 12 months is going to be even more insane. But one of the big things is that we have a government in, and by the way, even though I work for a Labor senator, I'm not in that party, and I'm not, pushing their stack for you today, but I am... just wanted to give you a bit of a grounding as to why things are changing so fast in Australia. There are a lot of government policies, most of which have been brought in by this government, that have changed everything. The National Broadband Network, fibre to the home in most of Australia, is going to mean that there will be a significant change. Of course, a lot of the pro intellectual property restrictive sort of agendas, the first thing they say when the NBN was being talked about was, well, that means people will just be able to download movies faster, so that's bad, so we shouldn't have it. The NBN is going to change a lot of things in that it's going to bring a lot more people, more engaged, more online, more able to participate in government through that mechanism. The second one is the digital education revolution, so the rollout of computers to high school kids right throughout Australia. Which doesn't seem like a big deal, except when you start thinking about the infrastructure that's being rolled out, the concepts of intellectual property and how that applies in those schools, and the fact that we're getting this much larger skill set that suddenly will be able to be implemented into the industry, which is good. You've got projects like GILF, which is the government, information licensing framework. Yep. Which is sort of looking at the application of Creative Commons to general government data. The Gershon Review, which a lot of people hate, but basically it was something that looked at the use of ICT in government and then made a series of recommendations. While people disagree with some of those recommendations, one of the really interesting things is that out of all the savings that it tried to make, it said that 50% of those savings had to go back into innovation projects. This was called the Innovation Fund or something. But that in itself is a really fantastic thing. So now all these government departments have money outside of their current budget to go and spend on new innovation projects. And that's a really exciting thing for driving forward new ideas and new projects. The digital economy agenda is sort of moving slowly, but the Information Commissioner and Freedom of Information Act has been changed, again, to try and make things more open, more accessible. And although we don't have a current specific government policy, obviously the stuff that's come out of the Government 2.0 Task Force that you heard from Lisa earlier on, is starting to define a bit of a policy for Australia around Government 2.0, around open government. And right throughout, particularly in the last year, there's been a lot of presentations and talks, even from our Prime Minister, Kevin Rudd, about how openness is becoming a core principle and a core focus for this government. So that's a really exciting political groundwork to sort of change the game a bit. In terms of interesting projects, the task force, of course, I can't at all understate the value of that task force report. It's going to change everything. It's already changing everything. At the very least, it's giving a lot of people that have been doing this stuff for years recognition and the ability to get on and with some credibility with their bosses do even more of what they've been trying to do for years. We've got this sudden exposure to this amazing innovation that's happening in a lot of the departments in Australia and agencies. We've got the Open Technology Foundation that Stephen Schmidt's going to talk about a bit later, which is starting up, and that'll create a fantastic support mechanism for open government. These mashup competitions, which created for the first time a serious understanding of the value that the general public can create if they have access to open data. A lot of public servants, a lot of politicians had no clue that that would be the case and were really, really impressed by the outcomes. And politicians experimenting, which of course I'll go into. But if you want to know why you think, why is government innovation in particular interesting, I'll just give you a short video. Can I have some sound, please? A short video which, to me, describes and illustrates the challenge of trying to innovate in government. I want you to think of the main character in this little skit as someone trying to do something really exciting and the other people around them to be his peers. Sorry? Yeah, exactly. Oh, we have no sound.
All right.
Why don't you try again? A little harder.
How's that?
This will be easier than I thought.
Just when you think it's going to be okay, maybe I'm not going to get beat up anymore for this. You will. And as you crawl back to your friends and colleagues, the least they can do is put a fire on your head. But
how did I do? There is now a level zero.
Anyway, it's one of my favorite movies. But every time I watch that, I think about the people who are pushing against the system to try to, and against the norms and the status quo to try and do cool stuff. And often enough, this is what they end up getting stung with. So, why define principles? I guess that as we're sort of playing with what we're doing in our office, which I'll go into soon, we've sort of started seeing that we believe there's a serious need to define principles. And the main reason for that, for the same reason that, you know, we've seen with many, many sort of government uses of IT in the past, is because we don't want to build a freeway to a cliff top. It's too easy to sort of get excited and about what the possibilities are, but if you don't build the foundations strongly, then it's all going to fall over and you're going to end up with a much worse situation potentially in the future. So I'm glad this all fits on the slide. We were looking at sort of key principles engagement. Those three pillars I was speaking about before is sort of our general broad principles. Key principles of engagement. This is a list which is very much in development, but I thought I'd sort of share it with you a bit today. Making sure you have low barrier to entry, including non-digital. There are certainly a lot of people, and you can't define it by age or by any other sort of mechanism, but there are certainly a lot of people who are or socioeconomic status, whatever, that won't be able to necessarily engage properly online at this point in time, but you need to be able to complement what you're already doing with online, because you're going to get such fantastic input that way. Go to where the community is. All these people that say, oh, we've built this fantastic online engagement, but no one's signed up. And it's like, well, if the community is already talking about that on Twitter, why don't you use the open API that Twitter has to actually pull that community into what you're doing? Why don't you go and have that discussion with them? Why don't you engage where the discussion's already happening? Which means that you end up having to have flexibility within whatever you're trying to do to incorporate different things as they come up, rather than a stuck and stable configuration. You want to make sure there's meaningful outcomes. This is a really, really important one. If you want to have a consultation and you're saying, we're going to have this lovely big conversation about blah, but there's not a point, there's not a specific goal, people are just going to get annoyed and then they'll probably just troll you, as I probably would. So you want to be able to say, the outcome of this is going to go to the minister, the outcome is going to define policy, the outcome is going to help us with the budgeting of a big project. So the outcomes of whatever you're trying to engage on has to be meaningful. There has to be transparency into how the engagement happens and to everything that everyone says. If there's a back channel and people pick up on it, and there's inappropriate things happening on that back channel, or any of the above, people will get very frustrated and feel like their input is just tokenistic. And so you need to make sure that there's transparency in how it all works. And you need to actually empower people. This is actually one thing that the Obama campaign did very well. People were able to be engaged with and empowered, whether they just wanted to donate $5 and that's all they wanted to do, or whether they wanted to get involved and run their own local things. You know, there was actually a series of ways that people could get involved. And that stepped level of engagement and personal empowerment was a very, very powerful part of that campaign. In terms of technical principles, and again, this list is under development, but we think it's an okay start. Sustainable data is something I've been trying to argue for many, many years, which ends up including open standards, open APIs, certainly looking at making it visible and making it accessible. Our discoverability. If your data isn't able to be found, then it's useless, which usually means trying to not lock it up behind a paywall or behind a login, making sure it's machine readable, making sure people can actually automate systems to be able to access it and use it. Interoperability, of course, we would all understand and agree with that. Flexibility and control, if you can't modify your system to deal with new and interesting ideas that are coming up, then what's the point? Reuse and sharing. Don't reinvent the wheel every time. The siloing point that was made before, I've definitely seen a lot of that. And it's a lot in the research community as well, which is a massive pity, because there's a lot of research that's constantly being redone because everyone wants to be the one that's discovered it. And trust. You know, you want to be able to have not so much a fluffy I trust you as an individual, but a technical trust of the system, which to me ends up meaning open source, because you want to be able to trust that the system is doing what you're saying it's going to do. So there are some sort of basic principles we've been playing with. I don't think I've got too long to go. And all of these principles are a lot of FOSS solutions will actually by default deal with a lot of these principles. Actually, just before I go into that, it's been interesting because a lot of people in both political and departmental sort of offices are asking our office about you know, what do they need in terms of resources? And I usually turn around and say, get yourself an open source gig. And they're like, oh, why? And it's because, well, weirdly enough, the basic principles that we all work by every day, whether it be in our project, in our community, in IRC, wherever, that those basic assumptions will drive a certain sort of behaviour and thus give you a certain sort of success. It's been really difficult for me to actually start to quantify and understand some of the things that I do quite naturally because of the communities that I've been involved in and because of the way that I've learned to do things. And now actually having to quantify it and write it down and teach someone who's never participated in an open community how to participate in, openly is has been a bit of a challenge for me. Anyway, so what is public sphere? Public sphere is obviously a term that way predates us. It goes back to Habermas, and you know, it goes back a long, long way. But what we've done is we've defined something that we were looking for a term to describe it, and we thought that public sphere best described it. Which is all about trying to collaboratively design policy with the public. So rather than putting up a call for submissions and people write in and spend a day or a week trying to write a submission or pay a lobbyist to do the same thing or whatever, the submissions go into a black hole, something's written, and then at some point down the track something is published, and usually you can get access to all the submissions somewhere separately, but there's no link between what's submitted and what's policy. There's also no opportunity for peer review, and even though the system has worked reasonably well, I mean there's a lot of people that don't like it, but it has actually worked reasonably well for couple of centuries now in Australia, we have a lot better ways that we can engage people in the process now. So what we want to try to do was to co-design policy with the public. And we're not trying to add to the already extraordinary weight of existing political officers and bureaucrats, because they're already carrying a little bit too much. What we're just trying to do is to tap into the fact that there is such amazing expertise and just straight out experience in the general public, and if we're not tapping into that, then we can't make the best possible decisions and the best possible policy that we can. So, what is public sphere? Basically what we do is we choose a topic. So far we've run three in our office, and all three of them have had to do with ICT, because we know that community, we know that they can engage well online, and we know the various ministers involved. So we choose a topic, we approach the political office or the minister that's in charge of that topic, and then we launch the topic and ask for comments and quotes. And we invite people to basically put forward talks, put forward their perspectives, tweet what they think to a hashtag, all this kind of stuff. We have a wiki where we collate all of the input, including the talks that happen on the day, including every tweet. This particular public sphere, the second one, which we ran on the topic of Government 2.0, which is a bit chicken and egg. But we had almost 3,000 tweets, a few hundred, I think it was 300 or 400 blog posts, comments, a few dozen posts, and a bunch of people just, sending us an email. We didn't actually have any letters to that one, but we said, if you, can't participate online, you can send us a letter, just with the knowledge that any letters or emails we would publish online as part of the public record of the input to this public sphere. And then the wiki, all of that was culminated into the wiki, and then anyone was able to contribute to edit, change the wiki. And what we ended up with was a fantastic, roughly 50-60 page document. I'll get to that. The event itself, we actually streamed live. So, and all of the events we streamed live. So the idea was, in this particular public sphere, we had about 180 people in the room, about 2,000 watching online, and about 500 of those 2,000 people were contributing online, which was really great. And we just found that it actually scales quite nicely. One of the public spheres, we actually had a series of remote nodes. So we had the main events out of one city, and then three other cities actually had events simultaneously where they were watching some of our stuff but also contributing back. And so we had hundreds and hundreds of people worth of ideas and recommendations and peer review of other people's ideas culminated into a briefing paper that went to the minister. A lot of this conversation happened on Twitter. There was the offer of completely offline contributions and a way to participate. And we ended up with this briefing paper that was handed over to the minister, and the minister then uses that to create policy. This is a first step for us. We don't see this as where public sphere needs to be, but it's a first step. And the first step was really showing that, yes, you do get quality outcomes and quality feedback by engaging with the public in an open and transparent way, down the track, what we want to see is departments and agencies, as part of their normal process of creating that Frank and Fearless advice to ministers and political officers, you know, that they can go through this kind of process to actually, as a normal part of the information gathering that they need to create policy. And then way down the track after that, we'd love to see the actual policy itself and the policy development itself and the policy makers engaging directly in this, so the policy itself is actually defined in this kind of way. But that's a fair way down the track. The other thing is that we've now very happy to see that this sort of general method and model, which is relatively low-tech, relatively easy to do, it just hasn't been done much, is now being taken up. So we've had three other public spheres, one by a state government, which was the New South Wales government, did this, and the Premier of New South Wales participated in such, it was great. I was run by Penny Sharp, who's an amazing person in the space as well. We've had a university do one, and we've also had a federal department and minister's office run one as well, which we were engaged in all three of those. So it's just been really exciting to see this model start to be picked up. I guess I don't have much time, so I just want to reflect very briefly on Gabriella's talk this morning as well. Everything she said was, like, it was a fantastic keynote to start, but this idea that she spoke about, the clear-sighted irony, and the convergence of openness and closedness, I think what we're seeing at the moment is probably more general understanding in mainstream media and in mainstream politics, which is sort of an important to get these kind of changes happening in government, where there's more understanding about openness versus closedness than we've ever seen before. There's still a lot of work that needs to be done. There's still a lot of education that needs to be done. It's very hard. I am pretty much alone in all of the political offices we're dealing with at this point in terms of people who have geek knowledge and understanding and experience. So I would actually strongly recommend all of you, you know, touch base with your local members and just, you know, offer a hand, offer some insight, offer some understanding and advice, because they really would appreciate it and really would need it. And if they don't appreciate it, well, they should. There's a great need for getting more of this knowledge out there, but we are in a fantastic position where the conversation is in that mainstream, and so we should be jumping on board and trying to help with that position, and with ensuring that where we're going is actually truly open. So I guess that's my talk. I'll open up for questions now. I hope that was useful to you, and thank you very much. Any questions? No, hold on. Yell it out, I'll repeat it for the first one.
Of the governments that you work for, so the example I'm thinking of is filtering.
Of course. I knew it was going to be the first question.
But this is just an example. I don't want to actually talk about filtering itself.
We can do that.
That from this question. How do you go about educating parts of the government which seem to clearly reject the sort of openness and transparency that you advocate so much?
Yeah. Okay, first of all, it has been really fascinating for me in this position because I had a friend that worked in the department who, back when I was sort of doing quite serious lobbying to try and do exactly that, every day would pretty much laugh at me and sort of tell me I'm going about it wrong. And I'm getting that feeling now when I watch a lot of openness advocates. I'm doing my best to try and share the knowledge about how to do this usefully. First of all, it's never as clear-cut as clearly rejected this or that. None of them are 100% one way or the other. So it's really important, first of all, to remember that politicians are people. You would not believe some of the abuse that people are just happy to throw it at politicians. That, you know, it seems fine from one person, you know, from you just saying it because you're feeling cranky or upset or whatever. But it completely marginalises the message that you're taking. And so what I've seen is... filtering is a great example where I'm actually thinking about starting an anonymous cartoon actually with some of my experiences. But you've got this, on one hand, people in suits sort of saying we can't possibly engage with the general public because they're crude and abusive and not very constructive. On the other side, you've got the, what the, are you doing, you know, why don't you engage? And it sort of reinforces that perspective, whereas it should be completely the other way around. Generally, first of all, it's a case of putting forward your points in a constructive way. You always have more than one politician that represents you, so that you'll, particularly in Australia, you'll have your local, you'll have your state, you'll have your federal representative, plus the ministers for the areas that you're interested in. And in ICT at the moment, and this is certainly one of our problems in Australia, there's no less than 5 portfolios that cover these kinds of areas. I think that it's actually speaking to Minister Tanner, who's been who's the person largely behind the Government 2.0 task force, and has written some great text about open government in the past, speaking to Minister Ludwig, who's behind the Freedom for Information changes. As much as, you know, some of you may not like it, Minister Comeroy for the digital engagement side of things and for the filter sort of side of things. Minister Carr for innovation and industry. And then Kate, you know, Senator Lundy is a backbencher, but she's very much an advocate for trying to, for open government, for government 2.0 for this area. So certainly chatting to her is useful as well as your local representatives. But there's also, and I'm just going to try and really stress this, try and understand what the agendas are. Usually people don't want to do something bad for the sake of power or for the sake of being bad. You've got to try and understand what's going on so that you can actually shape your message in a way that's actually going to achieve what you're trying to achieve. So try to understand what's going on first and foremost so that you can hopefully tap into it. And no, not stop being such a geek. We should be absolutely proud and revel in our geekness, but we also need to be communicators. But most of, you know, emerging geeks, we have to actually be good communicators within our own projects. This isn't something, you know, just about dealing with the masses or with politicians. If we don't communicate well, our projects fail, so communication is actually kind of important generally.
Coming from a country that has quite strong ministerial advisors, New Zealand, such as Australia, New Zealand doesn't really have a tradition of ministerial advisors. I was wondering what the officials thought of the lobbying that you're doing, because it's really the departmental officials that are giving advice to ministers.
Sure.
In New Zealand, for example.
So first of all, I'm not lobbying. I'm sure I would get in trouble if I was lobbying. probably not from my boss, but probably from someone. In terms of Australia, all political officers will have a number of advisors. I'm the ICT advisor, but you know there will also be a, you know, advisors and all kinds of different things. So you're saying that politicians here don't have advisors per se? Yeah. Right. Okay. Yep. In terms of a minister's office, what I'm doing at the moment would be a lot more complicated, because because Senator Lundy is a backbencher, we are in many ways a lot freer to do some pretty cool and interesting stuff, which is part of the reason we've been able to do it. It's a lot more complicated and a lot more difficult in the ministerial office, because you're balancing what you want to do, what your advisors are advising you to do, what the political will of your party is, and then you're also dealing with a department which has all of its own, you know, internal politics and all the rest of it. So it is a very complicated thing. And yeah, panel. That's a much better idea. Much better idea, yes. Thank you.